Okay, you're the boss, just please tell me what to do. It's nice not to be the boss, just to be the slave, just to follow along. It's really nice, actually. No need to think, no need to do anything like that. That's wonderful. Anyway, it's nice to see so many people here on New Year's Eve. Yeah, New Year's Eve people usually do stupid things. But not here. Here we do smart things on New Year's Eve, which is very nice. And I know that Ajahn Brahm, he left back for Perth just last night, this morning, and he got straight back to the Dhammaloka Center in Perth. He went straight into Dhammaloka Center, and they're starting their New Year's Eve party right now in Perth. Yeah, so it's happening in Perth, it's happening here. So it's really nice, actually, that this is going on. It's so important that we take these opportunities to do something good, rather than doing things that are stupid and foolish, like getting drunk or whatever else it is that people do on a day like today. So I'm very, very happy and very pleased to see so many of you here. And the title for tonight's talk is How to Make Progress on the Path, How to Overcome Obstacles and that sort of thing, which is a very nice and very good title, I think, because it's one of those things that we want to really try to achieve as Buddhists, to always move forward to something positive, move forward to greater sense of happiness, greater sense of ease in our life, less suffering and less problems. This is really what the Buddhist path is about. And this is what the Buddha promises us. He says that if we do the practice in the right way, you will make progress, you will leave the suffering behind, and you will gradually increase in happiness. Isn't that a great message? It's just so, what else is there to life than that? This is what life is all about, isn't it? Finding more happiness in life, reducing suffering. And this is the promise if we live this life in the right way. Now, of course, there are sometimes people who are quite satisfied with just having an even life. They're not really looking for necessarily an increase in happiness. And you can use the Buddhist teachings in that way just to have a more even and smooth experience in life. That is okay, but also it is also good ultimately to try to actually achieve a greater state of well-being. When we talk about happiness in Buddhism, we don't just mean kind of, you know, euphoria or anything like that. We mean anything which is good, anything which is positive, anything which is kind of, you feel, whatever it is that's good in life, more contentment, more compassion, more kindness, more peace. All of these things are what we're actually talking about. And these are the things that are so close to us. And ultimately, these are the things that give life real meaning and real purpose. Everything else is kind of secondary. So how do we measure, first of all, how do we measure progress in Buddhism? How do we know that, what does actually progress mean? This is kind of the first issue we have to deal with. The Buddha is very explicit about this in the suttas. He talks about this because the Buddha, of course, realizes that as long as we are making progress, as long as we are moving forward, eventually we will get to those goals. Yeah, we will get to jhana, we'll get to nibbana and all these kind of things. So as long as you are making progress, then you're moving in the right direction. You know, one day, maybe not this life, but eventually you'll get to these kind of goals that we're looking at, because that's what happens if you keep making progress. So what does it mean? And the way the Buddha defines this, and he defines it, of course, as increase in mindfulness. So your mindfulness gets better over time. He talks about your samadhi, your ability to sustain your attention on your meditation object increases. But in general, it is about increasing in wholesome states, the good states, and declining in the bad ones. This is basically what it is about. What are these good states? Well, obviously, mindfulness is one of the most important ones, but really everything, your degree of kindness, your degree of compassion in the world, your understanding of other people, the decrease in ill will, decrease in powerful desires, decrease in confusion and all of these kind of things. And if you see this happening, and you have to measure over quite long periods of time, you can't just measure from one day to the next, right? Because one day happy, next day kind of goes like a yo-yo sometimes. But you measure over a certain period of time, 6 months, a year perhaps. So you go on a retreat, I don't know, Jhana Grove perhaps. Have many of you been to Jhana Grove here? Yeah, only one. Okay, no. Okay, oh, that's more like it. Okay, good. I was getting worried there for a second. We've been really bad marketing, John McGrove. Only one person. Okay, maybe I should do some more marketing tonight. So you go on a retreat. It doesn't have to be Dhammagraha. It can be anywhere where it is nice and peaceful and conducive to meditation practice. And then from one year to the next one, you measure, you feel, are you feeling any better than you did last year? And if you are, then you know you're heading in the right direction. If you're not, if it's the same, it usually doesn't go down. It's very rare for things to go down. Sometimes maybe a little bit for a while, but usually doesn't go down. But if it still stays the same, that is when you have to ask yourself, what is the obstacle? Is there a problem here? Is there a reason why I'm not making any progress? Because if there is no progress, it is almost as if you lose the purpose of the spiritual path. And if you lose the purpose, eventually you're going to be fed up with being a Buddhist, and you're going to end up as a Christian, maybe, or maybe something else. Is there anyone here who's thinking about giving up on Buddhism? Becoming a Christian instead? No? Okay. So maybe it doesn't matter, but the point is that to really sustain this, to really keep your faith and confidence in the Buddhist teaching going, you're going to have to feel a sense of success and accomplishment, that you're moving towards a greater purpose, a greater aim. Then it's going to work out for you. So this is how the Buddha says we measure success. And so what do we do then to actually enable us to move forward all the time? And I have just been finishing a little retreat in Muar up in Malaysia, next door to Johor, but close to Malacca, right? Next door to Malacca, pretty much. And one of the things we did there, we had a look at the life of the Buddha. We spoke about the life of the Buddha for a couple of days. And the life of the Buddha is always a very good starting point for deciding how to do our practice. Because the way the Buddha talks about his own life and talks about his own practice is as an example for all of us and how we should live as well. The Buddha says, this is what I did. And of course, what the Buddha did is precisely practicing those things that lead to greater happiness. In fact, all the way to awakening itself. So when we read the suttas, when you read the word of the Buddha, it is good to remind yourself that the word of the Buddha is supposed to be, when he talks about his own practice, is supposed to be an inspiration for each one of us to practice in the same way. And to be able to do that, one of the critical things is actually to look at the Buddha in the right way. One of the problems very often with a traditional Buddhist country, I don't know, is Singapore, is that a traditional Buddhist country? It's kind of a little bit traditional, but a little bit non-traditional. It's kind of a mixed bag of things. But very often what you find in a traditional Buddhist culture is that they kind of place the Buddha on a pedestal, which is so high that the Buddha becomes like different from what it is to be an ordinary human being. The Buddha almost becomes like a god. And then you pray to the Buddha, I'm going to please help me, Buddha. It's like, it's really exactly like a god. There's no difference from the Christian god and the Buddha. Basically, all comes down to the same thing here. But this misses the point. The point of the Buddha is that he was a human being. He was like the rest of us. And the practice that he did because he was a human being is exactly the same practice as we should be doing as well. So for the Buddha's life to be meaningful for us, what we have to do is we have to first of all understand that the Buddha was a human being just like the rest of us. But this difference between the Buddha and us is that the Buddha took the human potential to its highest possibility. That is really the difference. But in essence, we are the same. And once you get that, then when you read the suttas, then when you start to see how the Buddha talks about his own life, it becomes an inspiration for each one of us. You think, wow, this is what the Buddha did. He was human. He could do it. I can do it too. This is what the Buddha is trying to say. This is how we should read his message. Then you understand the Buddha in the right way. And then you can actually take some of that message out of the suttas and then use that in your own practice. So what is that message? And one of those messages, there's kind of lots of messages, but one of those messages is that to make progress on the Buddhist path, one of the essential things is that you use wisdom in how you look at your practice. Use your ability to reflect. Use your ability to look at things with the eye of wisdom rather than using willpower or force, all of these kind of things. Wisdom power is far better and far more useful, far easier, far less stressful than always using willpower. So use wisdom power. Don't use willpower. Use wisdom power in your practice. Then you'll be on the right track. So what does that mean? How does that come out in the story of the Buddha? And one of the places it comes out, and this is before the Buddha becomes the Buddha, he's still the Buddha to be. He's practicing, or he hasn't actually started practicing yet. And this is why he's still living at home. And one of the things that he thinks while he's living the home life, he thinks that there is a problem in life. There is death, there is old age, there is suffering. There is a basic problem. And the basic problem is that we're all going to die eventually. That is essentially what it comes down to. So the Buddha then uses the idea that I'm going to die. Not only am I going to die, but all the things that I hold on to in the world, all the people, all the things I have, are also going to die. They're going to have to be taken away from me. And he uses that idea, and he takes it so deeply, understands it to such a high degree, that actually that becomes the thing that makes him go forth and become a monastic. That is basically the thing, yeah. Very often we think that the Buddha is all about compassion for all beings, is about kind of this big cosmic view about what reality is about, is going to help everyone in the whole world. But no, the Buddha's own story about why he went forth is basically because he understands that suffering is a problem in the world. How can I overcome suffering for myself? And the main thing there is actually the idea of death, yeah, because death is one of the most difficult things to face in life. I just went to hospital today and saw someone who was very sick with cancer, and you can see how hard it is when you come to that stage in your life. It's actually very difficult, and one of the reasons why it is difficult is because we have built up so many attachments, so many things in the meantime, that when it comes time to let go, you're not actually able to do it. So the difference between us and the Buddha is that the Buddha took a simple thing like death. It's so simple. It's so obvious. We all know we're going to have to die. Yeah. Is there anyone here who's not going to die? No, there's... Right. Everyone's going to die. We know that. We know it, but we don't know it. We know it superficially. We don't know it in a deep way. And that is the difference. But the Buddha, he knew it so deeply that he actually decided to go forth. And on the basis of that, he found awakening itself. Then he started the Buddhist teachings. And now, 2,500 years later, we're still here, still reading the suttas of the Buddha. And the reason we're doing that, the reason why we still have this teaching 2,500 years later on, is for one simple reason, that one person thought about death in such a profound way that this is what actually was the outcome of that. That's amazing, isn't it? And it shows you the difference between using wisdom in a really profound way and using it in a more superficial way. The more deeper, the more powerful the wisdom is, the more ability it has to drive us and do something for the path. So this is the first example in the life of the Buddha, where the Buddha uses wisdom in this way. The second example is after he goes forth. And after he goes forth, he has, just like all other human beings, he has problem with defilements in his mind. Yeah. So if you ever have defilements in your mind, you are in very good company. So anyone here who doesn't have any defilements ever in their mind, it's just a common human experience. Almost everyone has defilements. So the Buddha has these defilements, and then what he says that the way he decides, the way he overcomes these defilements is actually very interesting here. Very often when you have a problem in your mind, you might kind of push it aside, get rid of it, and kind of think, yeah, I don't want that, you know, this is bad. You have ill will, and then you use more ill will to kind of get rid of the ill will. And you can see how that doesn't really work, yeah? That kind of, it just makes the problem worse in many ways. So what the Buddha does, when he sees a problem in his mind, instead of using willpower, he uses wisdom to deal with his problem. He asks himself, what is the result, what is the consequence of having these defilements in the mind? What happens if I have ill will? Where does it lead? And what he says is that when you have ill will in your mind, it leads to suffering. It leads to suffering for myself, it leads to suffering for other people, it leads to suffering for both. Yeah, suffering is unavoidable when you have a mind of ill will. And we know that's true, right? If you have ill will, usually just the ill will itself feels much nicer to have a sense of friendliness or metta. But also the outcome of ill will is often that we end up doing things that we're unhappy with later on. So it's a double whammy there. And it's bad for other people, it's bad for us, it's bad for both. And when you see that, and the Buddha says as soon as he saw that, he was able, that entire defilement just disappeared from his mind, just like that. Yeah. And this is just using wisdom power. There's no willpower at all. It's just a reminder that this is problematic. And if I don't deal with this, it's going to lead to problems down the road, suffering for myself, for my family, and for other people, whoever it is. So wisdom power has this ability to eliminate a problem. Bang! Just like that. Why is that? Why is it that when most of us think that ill will is bad or suffering, it doesn't go like that? And the reason, again, is because we haven't really reflected on it enough to see the full ramifications of ill will, to see the full ramifications of other defilements. And because the reflection isn't deep enough, that is why it doesn't really disappear just like that. If you see that something truly is suffering, truly is problematic, what happens? Yeah, and the simile that I always like to use, which is very clear how this works, is a simile. If you have a hot plate in your house, you have a hot plate in your house, somebody has turned it on, you're not aware of that, so you go, you put your hand on the hot plate. Now, if you put your hand on the hot plate, what happens? By accident, what happens is that, bang, you just withdraw. Yeah, you don't have to think, should I remove it or not? If you think it's too late already, you already burnt yourself really badly, it just happens automatically. And it's exactly the same if you have a defilement in your mind and you fully understand that this is problematic. What happens? The mind withdraws from that by itself. Just in the same way as the mind withdraws the hand from the hot plate. Why? Because it's suffering. It's problematic. So the reason why we don't withdraw our mind from these things is because we think there is some degree of happiness there, something to be had from ill will. And that is why we don't withdraw from that. So again, it's about using that wisdom power, reflecting on these things, and then eventually, you, as a consequence of that, you actually withdraw from these things, and it's no longer a problem in the same way. So this shows you the potential for using wisdom on the Buddhist path. And if we use it in the right way, we're going to have far more success in how we deal with things. So what does this mean in practice? What does it mean for each one of us in terms of how to live our lives, in terms of improving our own abilities and doing speeding up the path or whatever? The first example, this may sound like a fairly trivial example, but sometimes the trivial examples are sometimes the best ones, because often the things we have to deal with are quite trivial. Yeah, this is kind of life. Life is like this. And one of the problems in life is things that we get addicted to. And these days, the thing that people get addicted to, one of the main things, is like smartphones. Have you seen people getting addicted to smartphones? And I've seen people being addicted to these things. I've seen they have come to me in Bodhinyana Monastery, sitting in front of me, asking me questions. And while they're asking questions, they're holding the smartphone in one hand. And I think, there's no focus there. And then you talk to them, and they are really restless. They are agitated. You can see that there is no peace there. And all they're doing is looking at the smartphone and looking up and looking around, and there's kind of nothing going on. And you realize there is a problem with these smartphones. And of course, you read them out in the newspapers as well. You realize this is actually quite a serious problem in the modern world. This is something that we kind of have to be careful with. So if you find yourself being slightly addicted to your smartphone or addicted to anything else, the question is, how can we deal with these addictions in such a way that we can let them go more easily? And a thing like a smartphone, because it really is quite addictive, what you have to do is not to rely on your willpower to get rid of it, because using the willpower is never really going to work, because willpower is very weak. I don't know there was an experiment that was done quite a while ago. This was an experiment to show how weak willpower is. And this was a bunch of people who were supposed to be on, a diet or something. And then they had them walk past this pastry shop. They were on a diet. They're probably quite hungry when you're on a diet. They walked past the pastry shop. And in this pastry shop, they had all these beautiful pastries. And they were all for free. All you had to do is walk into the pastry shop and they will give you a pastry for free and you can eat as much as you like. What happened, and this was the interesting thing, what happened is that they were not supposed to eat those pastries because they were on a diet. But they had, so these people had different strategies in how to avoid eating the pastries. And there were some people, what they did, they said to themselves as they were walking past, oh, I'm just going to have a quick look, yeah, and then I'll walk past afterwards. And those people, they would usually succumb to the temptation. They would walk inside and then they would have that pastry. It was just too delicious. But those people who were successful in avoiding the pastry and keeping the diet going were the ones who realized the weakness of their willpower. And because they realized that, they didn't even look at the pastry shop. They pretended it didn't exist. And because they pretended it didn't exist, they were actually able to walk past. They knew the fallibility of their own mind. They knew the weakness, the temptation that was going to arise as a consequence of going there. So they avoided even looking at it. And this is a very good lesson in how to deal with temptations in life. Yeah, if you're going to be able to give up your smartphone or whatever, you have to make it inaccessible. If it's sitting there next to you and you're trying to meditate and it's kind of there, you are it's going to be really, really hard. It's going to be impossible. So what you have to do is, after a certain time at night, you have to actually put it somewhere where it isn't accessible. And when it isn't accessible, then it tends to also disappear from your mind. So get your partner, yeah, your husband or wife or your mom or dad or your, whoever it is in your family, and you know that this smartphone is not bad for you, say, take my smartphone, put it somewhere I don't know about, yeah, give it back to me tomorrow morning. Yeah. And that is kind of the way that you can actually deal with these things. You have to make it really hard for yourself. Then there is a chance you will be able to deal with these things. So this is just an example, but you can expand this example to so many things in life, and you have to be careful to use wisdom. Yeah, don't just try to use willpower. You're not going to succeed. And by using wisdom, you will actually succeed in getting rid of some of these addictions that we all succumb to every now and again. So this is just a fairly small example. A more powerful example of how to kind of grow in qualities is to often use the adversities that we have in life. Adversities are often sometimes when you have adversities in life, we kind of wallow in the suffering. We think, oh, it's so terrible, it's so hard, it's so difficult. But instead of wallowing in the suffering, which is kind of useless, we use the experience of suffering as a potential for growth. Yeah, and this is so powerful, because what that does, it gives the suffering a kind of meaning. It gives us something on the spiritual path that can help us move forward. And when suffering has meaning, it transforms the suffering from something unbearable to something that actually becomes even useful on the spiritual path. I'll give you an example. This is and give you a couple of examples of how this works. And one example is sometimes when people look at the modern world, they look at the politics of the world, they look at some of the politicians that are around. I shall not mention any names, of course, but you can have some ideas. Some of the politicians we see around the world, and some of the kind of sometimes terrible policies that are put in place that are so inhuman and unfriendly and uncompassionate, all these kind of things. Or you have a look at the environment in the world. Yeah, you see kind of whales washing up on beaches and they're full of plastic inside because they've eaten so much plastic, because there's all this rubbish everywhere. The oceans are full of rubbish. Yeah, one of the biggest rubbish dumps in the world are the oceans. What a terrible thing it is. And you look at all the refugees everywhere who are kind of from war-torn countries, desperately trying to get away from terrible suffering. But of course, very often very difficult, because nobody really wants too many refugees, because it overwhelms your own society. So much suffering, so many problems, and sometimes so few solutions. Where are the solutions to these things? And because it is so hard to find the solutions to many of these things, what often happens as a consequence is that people sometimes become depressed. If you watch too many news on TV, it's easy to get depressed by the state of the world. And many people do that. And still, they go back and watch the news. I'm getting depressed. Oh, but I got to see the news again. And we kind of carry on watching the news. Sometimes I would really recommend you just forget about the blooming news. Turn it off. Don't go back. It's not all that useful. You know, it's going to be the same thing again every day anyway. A few different actors, but basically the same plot every day. More suffering, more killings, more murders, more bad things. It's like a digest, kind of all the worst thing that happened in the world put together in 20 minutes. And that's going to be pretty bad. All the good things that happened in the world, we never hear about it. You never hear about people coming here to the BF on New Year's Eve. That's really good news. So it's actually a very distorted outlook on humanity, what you see on the news. So for that reason, I sometimes much better just to turn it off, not worry about it. So how can we use this? How can we use all this suffering and all these things that are happening around us in a positive way to enhance the spiritual path? And you can. This is kind of the point. And the way to do that is to understand that the world is really outside of our control. We do our little part. We help out a little bit. We clean up a little bit around our area. We give a donation every now and again to a good cause or whatever it is. We do our part. But in the end, you cannot decide. It's not up to you who is in the White House. Yeah, it's not going to, you know, and all of these things, and whether the pollution, all the oceans get polluted or not, is really outside of your control. And once you start to understand that the world is essentially out of control, the world is basically going to have to go its own way, the deeper you understand that, the more you let go, and the less interest you actually have in kind of many of these large pictures. Yeah, and you can let go of the world. And one of the powerful consequences of letting go of the world, having a sense of, oh, it's just too much, is that you turn away from that. And then when you close your eyes and you go into meditation, actually your meditation works so much better. Why? Because the world is no longer of as much interest as it was before. The reason why meditation doesn't become peaceful is very often because we think about the things of the world. Yeah, we think about the future, what we're going to do, etc., about our hopes or whatever it is. But when you understand that the world is out of control, the more you get that, the less interest you have in worldly phenomena, the more you turn inwards, the more you can let go, and the better is your meditation experience as a consequence. So how we look at it is actually by far the most important thing in how to deal with life. So when you look at the news, yeah, don't get depressed. See it as an opportunity. It's an opportunity in letting go, an opportunity in allowing things to be that actually you have no control over. This is really the ideal way of dealing with this. So that is the world. And actually there is in the suttas, I always like to quote the suttas, you know, the word of the Buddha. Is that okay? Can I quote the suttas? Yeah, okay, thank you. So the Buddha actually has a word for this. It actually exists right there in the suttas. And in the Pali it's called the Sabbaloka Anabirattisanya, which means the perception of non-delight in the entire world. Yeah, and that perception of non-delight in the entire world is one of the perceptions that helps you in your meditation practice. Seeing that the world is out of control, understanding you have no idea where it's going to go next. Yeah, and once you see that, you stop taking refuge in the world. What does it mean to take refuge in the world? It means that you expect the world to go in a certain way. You expect the political situation to be stable. You expect the environment to be sorted out. And when that doesn't happen, you suffer because you're taking refuge in the world. So instead of taking refuge in the world, which is out of control, you take refuge in the triple gem, like we did before. You take refuge in your spiritual practice. You take refuge in the happiness and contentment that comes from living well, rather than in something which by its very nature is out of control. Sabbaloka Anabirattisanya. I'm going to test you on that word next time I come here. It's a long one, yeah? But it's one of these nice words that kind of give you an idea of what the Dhamma is about when it becomes very profound and also very useful. So this is about letting go a little bit of the world. Don't worry too much about it. Withdrawing a little bit, closing your eyes. When you close your eyes, actually, it's so happy to just go inside of yourself and let all that suffering of the world leave that outside and let that kind of go its own way or whatever. So this is the first thing to do. Yeah? Does that make sense? Everyone? Yeah? Makes sense? Okay, good. Yeah. So try it out, and with so many of these things, you have to develop it over time. Yeah, it only really works when you develop it over time, so you have to do it again and again and again, and after a while it starts to sink in, and then it becomes something powerful in your practice. And as you do that, as you let go of the worldly things, of course, it's going to kind of enhance, going to get rid of the defilements, and things are going to happen, whatever it is that you're doing. Yeah. The second thing I want to talk about briefly is how to deal with other people. Yeah, one of the biggest sufferings in life is other people. Is that true? Yeah. It's true, isn't it? Because people can often be one of the greatest sources of joy in life, but they're also one of the greatest sources of suffering. So it's important to know how to deal with it. And of course, sometimes there are people we find very difficult in our life, and need to be able to deal with those. But sometimes the most important people to be able to deal with in a good way is the people who are closest to us. People like our family members, our work colleagues, people that are very close to our hearts are often very important. Because if we get those relationships right, then the rest of the relationships we have tend to be fairly easy to sort out. And one of the things that always struck me when I was reading the suttas again, as I always kind of refer back to the suttas, the word of the Buddha, is that where the Buddha talks about how to create harmony in the Sangha, in the monastic Sangha. How do you create harmony between the monks? And perhaps you think that the monastic Sangha is like a heaven realm where nobody, everyone is just kind of always friendly. There's no problems. Of course, it isn't like that. There's no such thing. As long as you are in the human realm, there's always going to be disagreements, sometimes arguments, and sometimes problems. That's just the nature of human beings, because we look at things differently and all of these kind of things. So what the Buddha says, if you want to have harmony in the Sangha, the very first thing we should do is to obviously have metta for each other. Metta means loving kindness, friendliness. So how are we going to have this loving kindness and friendliness to each other? And sometimes people sit down in a meditation and say, oh, may all beings be happy and well, and then the snore, and then kind of, may they all be happy and well. And it doesn't really bite, it doesn't really actually work all that well. So the Buddha says the place to start with having metta is not just sitting down and kind of trying something which doesn't really have all that much effect. Do it in your actions. Have metta in your actions. And so this is a very practical way of thinking about metta. And not only having metta in your actions, then metta in your speech comes afterwards. But the people who we should have metta towards, the Buddha said specifically to the monastics, the people you should have metta towards, the first ones, are your fellow monastics. These are the most important ones. And this is very interesting. And it's interesting precisely because the people who are closest to us are often the people who are most difficult to have metta towards. It's like when you live in a family, because the habits are so strong, because we know each other's weaknesses and bad qualities and good qualities, whatever it is, so well, it's very difficult to have consistent metta and love and friendliness for your closest family members. It's easier to have metta towards some idealized person in your mind. Ajahn Brahm, he's such a saint. Oh, may you be well and happy, Ajahn Brahm. So easy. You don't even know Ajahn Brahm, for goodness sake. The point is that idealized person is far easier. And that's why often when you do metta meditation, you don't actually do it towards individuals. You do it maybe towards a direction or something like that. We don't actually have to deal with individuals, because individuals are too hard to deal with. So this is what you do. So have metta towards the people who are closest to you, towards your family members, your mum, your dad, your kids, your husband, your wife. And if you're able to be kind to them, then I guarantee you, it is very likely you will be able to be kind to almost anyone in this world. Because that is really the basic ground of practice, the people who are close to you. If we have a harmonious monastery at Bodhidharma Monastery down in Perth, and usually it's very harmonious, very rarely that you see the monks arguing about anything. I can barely remember the last time it was, actually. It's very, very rare. And that happens precisely because you learn to focus on the good qualities in the monastics around you. And it's very easy, because the monastics, at the very least, they're trying to have a very high standard, a very high ideal. It's very beautiful. And the same thing with the members here of BF. Is that right, Eileen? Have a very high standard, people come here. Why do they come here? Because they want to be good. They want to have a good heart. At least they want to try. The intention is in the right place. And that is worthy of so much respect. And if you remember that, you remember this all the time, keep that uppermost in your mind, then you can have that kindness and compassion to the people around you. In your family, it's exactly the same thing. Look for the good qualities. They guarantee there are lots of good qualities in the people closest in your family. Look for those. Focus on those. Remember those all the time. Let go of those silly habits that you have from the past. And then you will be able to be kind and generous and all those things, even to the people who are closest to you. It's hard work, but it's really, really worthwhile. So this is where we start out. And once you start out like that, you are generous, you are kind in body and speech to your family members. Yeah, if you can. Sometimes it is very, very hard. If you are in a family where it is very difficult, then it is not. You don't become a bad person just because you can't. It's important to recognize that some people have very difficult family relationships. So you just do your best. And if you're at least you're doing your best, that is all you can do. And then, once that is in place, then you also start to have metta in your thoughts, yeah, towards these people. You think about them in kind ways. One step at a time, bodily action, verbal, how you speak, and then how you think about people. Yeah, and then eventually, when you think about people in the right way, then you can do the metta meditation, because then your heart is kind of open to the people around you. Then it's possible to actually wish people well in a very meaningful and profound way. So getting things right. So coming back to the problematic people in the world, how do we deal with the really problematic people in the world? Yeah, people at work, for example, who are just absolutely impossible and really kind of so much dukkha to be around. What do we do when someone has no good qualities? Yeah, sometimes we come across people, I can't see any good qualities in them. What do I do? Please give me some advice. And there's actually some very simple advice to use when you have people who are absolutely impossible. And that is to always remember that people who are so difficult, they also have a lot of suffering in their life. People who are very hard to work with, people who have lots of bad qualities, will usually feel really bad about themselves. And not only do they feel bad about themselves now, but they carry with them all this backlog of bad qualities that they will take with them into the future. And they will carry on that suffering for a long, long, long time in the future. So when there is someone that you cannot see any good qualities in, all we can see is bad qualities, have compassion. Yeah, here is a person who wants to be happy. Here is someone who thinks they are doing what will lead to happiness in the future, but actually they are doing things that will lead to suffering in the future. Yeah, they don't understand. They are deluded about reality. They don't understand the connection between our actions and our happiness. And because they don't understand that connection, they're acting in a way which actually leads to their own suffering. The Buddha says in a very nice sutta, not actually the Buddha, it's actually King Pasenadi who says this to the Buddha. He says that those people who are acting towards others with unfriendliness, they are acting as if they are their own enemy. Yeah, why is that? Because if you act with others in an unfriendly and unkind way, you're causing suffering for yourself in the future. And that is what your enemies want for you. Yeah, so you're acting as if you are your own enemy by not being kind and friendly to other people. So be your own friend. Yeah, be your own friend by acting with kindness towards others. It's a beautiful way of thinking about this idea that being kind to others is actually being kind to yourself, being your own friend. So this is the way to look at this. Yeah, people who really, where you cannot see any good qualities, it doesn't mean they haven't got any good qualities, it means that you can't see them. Sometimes we are blind to other people's good qualities. If people haven't got any good qualities, remember, they are worthy of compassion. And when you do that, something marvelous happens. And that marvelous thing that happens is that instead of being so self-centered, instead of always thinking about ourselves, oh, so much suffering, I have to be around this person, it's so problematic. That self-centeredness is a kind of small mind and narrow. We feel kind of in our own little world. Yeah, everyone else is dangerous outside. And we kind of, that's what ill will and greed feels like. It feels like you are confined into your own little space. Yeah, you are kind of tiny little world. But once you turn things around, instead of thinking about yourself, instead of having that selfishness there, instead you have compassion for the other people, suddenly things expand out, and suddenly the world kind of becomes large. You include everyone else in your world, and when you do that, the mental state that you have is so beautiful compared to the state of ill will or the state of greed or whatever it is, which is narrow and confined. It's a wonderful thing. It's a little trick of perception. Turn your perception around, and that little trick of perception is enough to change the feeling from being small, narrow, confined, to being large and expansive, and including of all other beings around you. It's a wonderful thing when you see these little things happening, because these are the things that make life really meaningful, and you feel that you are really progressing on the path when that happens. So this is a nice way of looking at other people. Remember, when other people do bad things, very often they are trapped by their bad habits. They are trapped by their personality. They are trapped by things that they ideas and things that were laid down maybe in a past life, long, long time ago. Often they don't have any choice. They have to be like that. Yeah, no point in getting angry. If someone is acting for their own suffering, whatever, because of a program inside of them, because they're acting like robots, your only thing you can have which makes any sense is compassion for them. Everything else doesn't make any sense at all. And then you are on the right track. Then things start to change in your practice. So all of these things are general principles that you use. And as you apply these general principles in life, you actually start to see things happening, things changing. So that is about other people. What about our own problems? What about our own kind of things that aren't perfect? Is anyone here who is absolutely perfect? Yeah, okay. It would be really funny if somebody raised their arm. That would be actually, I'm perfect. So, and this is the thing, People, generally speaking, aren't perfect. And one of the things is that, and for that reason, it is not painful to admit sometimes that we have flaws. Yeah, it's okay to admit that. And one of the beautiful little passages that you find in the Dhammapada is where the Buddha says that when somebody points out a flaw in your character, you should see it as someone pointing out a treasure. I think I probably mentioned this here before because it's such a nice little thing found in Dhammapada. And the idea is that sometimes it is very hard to see our own flaws, because we're so close to them. And we don't really want to see them. We don't really want to know that we have all these flaws. So because that, we kind of shut it out. And sometimes it takes somebody else to point it out. So if somebody comes to you and says to you, actually, you have a problem. Listen. No, they shouldn't. If they say it like that, of course, then it's already wrong already. But if somebody comes out of compassion and kindness, like a spiritual teacher or a close friend or someone you trust, and they say it out of compassion, listen, maybe there is something that we can do here. Maybe there's a problem that we can resolve. And somebody says it in a nice way. It is always worthwhile listening. It is always worthwhile seeing what they have to say, because sometimes they point out things that are so deeply ingrained of us, so much a habit of how we do things, that it's impossible for us to see without somebody else pointing it out. So it's useful to be open to these things. So next time someone comes to you and complains about you, say, oh, thank you for pointing out the treasure. That's kind of the nice attitude to have, especially if they're coming from the right place, they're coming from kindness, and that is kind of a good attitude. And it's difficult. Sometimes we have to be brutally honest with ourselves. Then sometimes it is possible to make progress on this path. We have to actually really see what is there. If we try to hide from reality, if we try to stick our head in the sand like an ostrich, pretending reality goes away by sticking your head in the sand, then you're not going to succeed. But by being honest, by seeing things as they actually are, not stupid, not kind of blaming ourselves, which aren't really true, but when there is a problem, to accept that there is a problem and then deal with it as a consequence, then you're going to go a long, long way in this practice. So these are some of the ways that you can deal with problems. I'll mention maybe a couple of more things because we have a little bit more time. I don't know how. It's a couple of more things that I find very inspiring that I use in my own practice. And sorry, adding? Yeah, I'll take a drink. Okay, thank you. Yeah, you can see that. Compassion in action is very, very kind of you. Okay. So, one of the things that I like to use and I often talk about is the idea of death, that we're all going to die one day. And it's one thing that I would really recommend you to bring into your life, because it's a very, very useful thing to give rise to a sense of priorities. What actually is important in life, what really matters. And we can use this in many ways, but the way that I like to use it is I often think to myself that because I could die at any time, I don't know when it's going to be, one day I am going to die, and the one day that I'm going to die, that day I have no future anymore. The future is going to be gone. When you die, you don't know where you're going next, but certainly the future of this life is disappeared. So because I don't know when it's going to be, the only time for me to be ready is now. So really, the way to be ready now is to think of myself now, I have no future. Yeah, I have. And when I think of myself that I have no future because I want to be ready now, what happens? And something very beautiful happens when you have no future. There's nothing much more to think about. Yeah, if you look at your mind, you look at the things that kind of are important to you, that you think about, it's very often things that have to do with your family, it has to do with your work perhaps, it has to do with duties that you have to do. It's always very often something about the future, where you're going to go. But if you have no future, nothing much to think about. Yeah, your mind goes blank, empty. So the idea of death contemplation, of reminding yourself that all of these things have to come to an end. One day you're going to have to give all of these things up anyway. It's all going to have to go. Yeah? How much should we think about these things? How much should we invest in all the things of the world when it's going to have to go one day anyway? Don't make this into something heavy and negative. Use it only if it works for you and it gives you a sense of peace and quiet. This is very... It's a very powerful reflection. It is a reflection that the Buddha asked us to use again and again and again in the suttas. It occurs so many different times. Yeah, and because it occurs so often in the suttas, it is something that is very important in our lives. And I remember a man many years ago that I met in Australia. He was from Sri Lanka originally. He was a psychologist. And he told me that the way he did the death contemplation was to remind himself in the morning when he left his wife and children in the morning, he would always make sure that he'd left in a good way. Why? Because today I could die. I don't want to leave my children and my wife in a bad way if I could die. Why? Because how do you feel when you're dying if you have kind of had an argument with somebody or whatever? You feel bad about it. You're not ready. And because of that, we can really never really afford to have an argument with anyone. Yeah, because what happens if you die afterwards? You feel bad. You don't want to die feeling bad. What a terrible thing that is. So by keeping in mind the fact that you could die means that you can never afford to have an argument with anyone. You can never afford to do a bad action. You can never even afford to have a bad thought. Yeah? That's pretty hard. Yeah, that's difficult. You can't really afford it, but it's going to happen sometimes because it's just too hard to avoid that. But theoretically, you can't even afford to have a bad thought. And you can see you're moving in that way, moving in that direction, whereby you understand, you get your priorities sorted out. You know what is important in life. You don't allow yourself to be carried away by the stream of life. You have the craving which carries us forward in such a fast way that sometimes we forget what is up and what is down, what is black and what is white, what is good and what is bad. So keeping these things in mind is so important on the spiritual path. The last thing I would like to say, just very briefly, which is a very useful and general practical advice, is always to remember what really matters in life, what is important. It is so often that we forget the things that are really crucial. But remember that even our ordinary life, your family life, what is it that makes family life useful? What is it that makes it good? It's not just the fact that you have parents or children or a wife or a husband or whatever it is. That fact in itself is neutral. What makes family life useful is the quality of those relationships. If those relationships are based on love, compassion, understanding, kindness, generosity, wisdom, all of these good qualities, then they become useful. Then they become good relationships. Yes? So it is the spiritual, and all of these qualities, if you think about them, they are spiritual qualities. So it is the spiritual qualities in our life that make family life actually worthwhile, that make it important, make it work out. It is the same thing with all the relationships in our life. Yeah, whether it is going to work or whatever it is. Even at work, if you just work for money and promotion, after a while it becomes really hopeless. It becomes a joyless task of going to work every day if it's just for material things. It is how you work, yeah? How you deal with your customers, how you deal with your fellow workers and all these things. That is what makes work life also happy, yeah? My work life is like that too. Yeah, when I work, I try to do it with a kind of gentleness and kindness and all these kind of things. Of course, it's easier when you're a monk. Yeah, that's what you are. You're a monk. Yeah, it doesn't really count. It's too easy. But it's the same idea that when you're a monk or you are an ordinary job, same ideas that you have to bring to it. Then it makes it meaningful. And when you start to look at life like that, you start to realize what actually matters, what makes life worthwhile, what makes it work out. Spiritual qualities is what it's about. That should always be the priority. That should be number one. If you live your life with spiritual qualities, you're always going to feel more happy and content about things, because that is what spiritual qualities do. When you come to the end of your life and you die, you feel that you have lived your life in a good way. Now you come to the end of your life, you have to give up everything else. Everything else has to go in the world. Your family, your relationships, all the people you know, all the things you own in the world have to go. Your identity in this world has to go. Even your body has to go. There's only one thing that you carry with you into the future. That's your spiritual qualities. That is what matters again. So these are the things that ultimately give life meaning, both in the short run and the long run. So make sure you prioritize those things that give life meaning. Don't prioritize those things that actually are temporary, that are going to be there for a while, they're going to disappear again afterwards. Then you are on the right track. Then you know what is valuable and what actually works in this world. And what happens, one of the marvelous things that happens when you do that, if you live the spiritual life, everything else that you do in the world, whether it's the family or work or whatever, that becomes part of your spiritual life. You do those in such a way that it supports kindness, compassion. It supports your meditation practice. Everything is subsumed under the spiritual life. The spiritual life is priority number one. Everything else is secondary. What happens when you live like that is that when you sit down to meditate, instead of thinking about all those other things in the world, all those things that are you think are important, because they are secondary, you don't think about them anymore. Instead, you stay with the meditation object, because you know it is now you're doing your spiritual practice. This is what matters. Everything else is secondary. You don't think about it so much. But in so much of the world these days, the idea of meditation practice or mindfulness or whatever, people do this to improve their ordinary life. So your ordinary life is number one. The spiritual life or the mindfulness or whatever is secondary. And because it is secondary, because it is there to improve your ordinary life, it means that as soon as you close your eyes, because everything else is more important, you're going to think about it. Yeah? But turn it around. Make the spiritual life more important. When that is primary, then there is a possibility of finding peace of mind. And then you can become calm, even in the midst of all the hustle and bustle. At least sometimes. Not always, but occasionally you can become calm, even when things are really busy around you. So this is my suggestion for you if you want to have a kind of a New Year's resolution. Do you do that in Singapore, New York resolutions? Sometimes. If you want to have a New Year's resolution, make the resolution of putting your spiritual life first. And everything else, all the other things that you want to do, make them secondary. Because that is really the right attitude to having a good life now and also for the future. Okay. Whoa. Okay, that's pretty much an hour talking already. So... Good. Yeah. So if you would like to ask some questions or some comments, please do so now. Wait, this is the last chance to ask questions for 2018. Yeah, this is the end of 2018. So please now take the opportunity. Yes.
I have a few Christian friends.
Yeah.
So one of them asked me about Buddha. Is he a god? I said no, he's a human, just like our ancient Confucius. So then he said, "Oh, why don't you trust in our Christianity? Our God is Almighty." I suddenly doubt. I don't know how to reply because my friend, I don't want to affect our relationship. As you know, religion, when we talk further, can affect our friendship. So I'm not sure in future if I encounter this, how am I supposed to talk back?
Okay. Yes, it is very touchy. You know, they say that in English culture, you're not supposed to argue about anything, so you never talk about religion and politics, yeah, because that always ends up in an argument. So it's a good point. So it depends on what kind of friendship it is. If the friendship is something you value just because it kind of feels good and it's nice and it's, you're good friends and it's good for emotional support or whatever, then don't think about religion. But if it is a friendship that is more, also has kind of an intellectual side, a side where you want to talk about serious topics, yeah, and some friendships are like that, then it's okay to be honest about things and you have to talk about it. Otherwise, the friendship itself can stagnate. It doesn't really have any purpose anymore after a while. So I think it is good to talk about these things. And if someone says that our God is almighty, you know, the problem with that kind of argument is that, you know, where does this idea come from in the first place? And these are often just ideas. And the fact that someone is an ordinary human being, well, everyone can accept that because it's just obvious. Everyone is ordinary human beings. But that something is almighty is actually a much more difficult proposition to accept, much more difficult to kind of deal with intellectually. And there are so many problems with that idea. Yeah, when you think about it, if God is almighty, why did he create all these problems in the world? Yeah, it's an obvious one, isn't it? If you're almighty, you'd create something better. Why did he create me? I'm full of flaws. Are you full of flaws? Why did he create someone so full of flaws? Ask your friend, well, you have all these flaws. Why did God create you like that? See what it is. So, and this is actually a very serious philosophical problem, yeah? This fact that actually God is supposed to be almighty and all-loving, and still he created this big mess. That's really problematic. So it's okay to sometimes have a discussion. But one of the things that for me, Christianity never made any sense at all. I find it very, very strange personally. And to me, Buddhism was at least something that the very idea that it's all based on faith is problematic already. One of the beautiful things about the Buddha teaching is that you try it out a little bit, you check it out. Okay, so Buddha says, be kind. Okay, kind of makes sense anyway to be kind. So you try that, you do a bit of meditation, you see what happens when your mind becomes peaceful. You see what it leads to the results the Buddha is talking about. And lo and behold, it does. Yeah. Wow, it actually works. So you have something you can actually feel directly and immediately. It's powerful. Whereas with Christianity, it's far more based on just faith. Faith is often the end-all and the be-all of Christianity. And to me, that is problematic. If it is true, it's great. But if it isn't true, it's seriously problematic. Anyway, it's just some ideas. But yeah.
When you talk about letting the world, I mean, the world is a mess, so you cannot do anything about it, and you just have to let it go.
Yeah.
It disturbs me a bit, actually. Okay. Yeah. You know, it's like our local lingo, you know, you bocha, you know. That means you don't care.
Okay.
Right? How do you balance between this kind of feeling you don't care and that you have to do something about it?
I don't really mean that you should let go completely. What I mean is that you do your part, in society, for the world in general. I don't mean that the point is more like you know what you can do and you know what you can't do. You know the distinction between the two. And this is one of the signs of wisdom, is that you work as much as you can, and when you have done your part, then at that point you let go and you allow things to be here. This is really the critical thing here. But when you know, very often what happens when people watch too much news on TV, they despair. And the despair over things that actually they can do nothing about at all, yeah? They think, oh, Donald Trump is in the White House. How come he ended up in the White House? Yeah? You can't do anything about that. He's going to be there until his term is over. But you can't sit there kind of being angry and upset about it. It's not going to make any difference. And so many things that we are disturbed about in the world and make us angry are things we cannot do anything about. So do those things that you can do something about. Be friendly to the people around you. Be kind and generous to your family members. Support the Buddhist Fellowship. Yeah? No, this is I expect some kind of commission on that one. So, and also little things in your kind of in your immediate area around you, and then you are doing what you can without being despairing over the big things in the world. There. Okay, anyone else?
అంటే హౌ డస్ వన్ నో వెన్ వన్ హస్ అటెండ్ సో ఆన్
How do you know when to attend Sovan? Okay. Okay, so that, the meaning of that question is, how do you know when you have become a stream entry? Sovan is the Sinhala word for stream entry here. And the stream entry is one of the high attainments on the Buddhist path, yeah, when you kind of see the Dhamma for the first time. And one of the ways you know that, well, first of all, you have to attend to Samadhi, first of all, because Samadhi is the root, is the cause for stream entry to happen, yeah? And so first of all, you know, if you haven't attained Samadhi, there's no way that you are a stream entry. So first of all, you have to become incredibly peaceful, incredibly bright, with a very powerful mind, lots of happiness and joy in your meditation, and then there is a possibility that you can make a kind of breakthrough, a kind of insight. And how you know is, one of the ways that you know is that something explodes inside of you. The whole world gets turned upside down, and suddenly you're looking at the world in a very different way. One of those ways, of course, that you understand the idea of non-self, that there is no inherent essence in you. And one of the beautiful teachings in the suttas is this teaching that whatever ordinary people think is happiness, you know, as a stream mentor, is suffering. Yeah, whatever ordinary people think is suffering, yeah, you know, is actually happiness. So things have really turned around almost absolutely. You see the world in an entirely new way. Sometimes the idea of stream entry is very devalued in modern society. All kind of people claim to be stream entries. And I have had so many examples of people coming to me and they have said, "Oh, I went on this retreat. I was told I was a stream entry, but I didn't believe it." Yeah, and that's problematic. If you don't believe it, then the chances that you are a stream mentor is just about zero. It's absolutely, you know, there's no way at all you are a stream mentor. You know something has happened if you are a stream mentor. It's a massive experience. And it is said in the sutta specifically that the place where you became a stream mentor is the place that you should remember for the rest of your life. So you know where that was, because you know that's when the revolution happened, yeah? The inner revolution happened at that particular place. So you know her. So if something really happens in a meditation and you are completely blissed out for the next week, you don't know what to do, then go to Ajahn Brahm and ask him, "Oh, Ajahn, this happened. What does it mean?" And see what he says. Okay.
Okay, sorry, Ajahn. I think my question is similar to the previous one. Okay, sorry. I know that you have to meditate. That's the only way to get to where we want to go.
Yeah.
But I've been sitting, and nothing is happening. I just feel that it's useless.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but I know that's the only way.
Yeah.
But I don't seem to see any way.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. So the answer is that if you're not going anywhere, it's because you haven't really looked carefully enough at the causes that actually support meditation practice. And one of the things, there's two things that support meditation practice according to the suttas. One of them, the most important one, is sila. Sila means morality. It means much more than morality. It means your entire character development, yeah, all of these things. So what you have to do is you have to look at your overall sila. Yeah? Remember, sila does not just mean keeping the five precepts. It means everything to do with how you relate to other people, the degree of kindness you have, how you think about them. All of these things are part of the idea of sila. So ask yourself if you can do something more in the sila area. This is number one. Yeah? The second one is many of the things I was talking about tonight are things that have to do with your attitude to the world, how you look at the world. And that attitude is really part of right view. Yeah? It's called Udruka Ditti in Pali. It means straight view. And it is one of the supports, specifically said to be a support for meditation practice, for Satipatthana, according to the suttas. So ask yourself about your view of the world. Ask yourself if you can straighten it out a bit more. Ask yourself of the consequences. What does rebirth actually mean? What does it mean in terms of how I look at the world, how I relate to things? And one of the things that it means is that you start to value your spiritual life more and you start to value less the other ordinary things in life. This is one of the consequences of having the idea of rebirth. So go to those things. Read the suttas a bit more. The suttas is just one big mass of right view. Yeah? There's 10,000 pages of right view. Start with page one and just read through it. So very handy, yeah? It's all there. And just read the suttas that you enjoy. Read the word of the Buddha. If you don't enjoy a sutta, just kind of let it alone. Go to the next sutta. Don't like that one. Next one, next one, next one, next one. Okay, this one is good, yeah? And then you read that one. And this is the right attitude to have to the suttas, to the word of the Buddha. So you have to be inquisitive. You have to really ask yourself these questions in a deep way. What can I do better? How can I be more kind-hearted? A very kind-hearted person is also a person who has success in the meditation practice. Okay, so we have till midnight, is that right? 2.5 hours of questions? We'll see what happens.
I'm sorry, Ajahn. Namo Buddhaya.
Yeah.
Lately, I've been struggling between... So there are like two questions here. The very first one, how... Like, we are now living in a worldly situation where we go to work, we perform our best, like, everything is measurable, like, we have to come, you know, like, be the best and everything.
Yeah.
So how do I manage to perform very well and at the very same time, I will have to take care of the spiritual path. So how do I combine between spiritual path and worldly path? And at the same time, if I were to put like something like more towards spiritual, then I kind of like fail on the worldly path.
Okay.
Yeah, it has been a confusion there. Yeah, thank you, Ajahn.
Okay. Okay, so how to succeed both in the world and the spiritual path? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. Okay, so the I don't know about you, but one of the things that I have found is that the people who are most successful in life are the people who actually are very kind and caring people. I don't know if that's true. Sometimes you're kind of the scallywags in the world are successful, but the people who really are successful in a very kind of honest way, where people trust them and people kind of carry them forward because they are good people, they are precisely those people with good qualities. So in the long run, if you are kind to the people around you, if you're kind to your co-workers, to your customers or whatever, they won't be afraid of you. You know, people are often afraid of those people who are very competitive. Yeah, I'm competitive because I'm going to kind of get the better of everyone else and whatever. And people get afraid of you and they don't want to promote you. But if you are a person who doesn't really care so much about promotion, you don't care so much about the worldly values, but you just have a kind heart, you just are a good person, often automatically you will like float to the top, yeah, almost automatically, because people won't be afraid of you. They will say, oh yeah, this person, they can kind of be promoted or whatever. So kindness and care, in my experience, is actually a very powerful tool for success in the worldly life. So you have to find the balance somewhere. You should never throw the kindness out of the window. If you feel that you have to throw the kindness out of the window, you are prioritizing your short-term happiness in that work over your long-term happiness. It is not worth it. It is a crazy thing to do. Do you want to have short-term happiness but long-term suffering? It's mad. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. So you have to always be able to be kind. And if the work is so demanding you can't be kind, you're probably better off finding another job, to be honest. Because otherwise your priorities are all wrong here. So that's what I recommend. But this doesn't mean you should be lazy at work. I always recommend people to do what they have to do, because you always feel better about yourself if you work well. But don't work so hard that you actually destroy your other things. Yeah, find that middle way somewhere. And then you'll have a happy life, long-term and short-term and medium-term and super long-term or whatever else. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Hi, Ajahn. So I have a question regarding spiritual practice.
Uh-huh.
So what do you have to say about layman people who come and to know more about Buddhism, but to develop psychic abilities? That's what's happening.
that's what's happening. So someone is coming to Buddhism because they want to learn psychic abilities.
Yeah. Develop their psychic abilities.
Okay, what do they want?
Third eye or like...
Third eye, okay.
Teleport.
Okay. Do they want to do black magic as well? Is that what they want to do? Or, that is really bad karma, you know. If you develop kind of meditation to kind of do black magic, it's actually terrible because you want to hurt other people. That's really, really bad news. And usually it doesn't work out because if you have bad intentions, actually samadhi doesn't usually work if you have bad intentions. So usually it doesn't work. So I would say that if that is your motivation for learning meditation practice, chances you will succeed are actually very small because you have to actually go into all of this with a very high and noble intention. The more noble your intention is, you have to have the kindness there, you have to have the love, the compassion for all people. The more noble your intention is, the more chances you have in your meditation practice. If your intention is just to have the third eye, it's kind of, it's not very noble, it's kind of very worldly. It's a bit like kind of want to have a high salary, it's the same kind of thing. It doesn't really actually get you anywhere. So I think it's a waste of time. You know, you can't really stop people from doing it. You kind of, you know, whatever, shrug your shoulders. But they're not actually going to. I think it's very unlikely they will succeed. So try to kind of. But sometimes what you need to do is that people who have an interest in meditation, you kind of, okay, come in. Yeah, if that's what you want to do, fine. And then sometimes they actually learn something later on. They learn something about Buddhism. They learn something about these teachings that is profound. And they start to change their attitude. Yeah, they come around. The reason why they want to have the third eye, because they think it's going to be cool. Yeah, it's going to be nice. It's going to be happiness for me. I can go to my mates and I can tell them, yeah, I got the third eye. Yeah, I can see your mind. I can read your mind or whatever. And they think that's great. But actually, it doesn't lead to much happiness. Imagine if you have the third eye and you can read everyone else's rubbish thoughts, yeah? It's terrible. There was a story about this Indian sadhu. The word sadhu, by the way, sadhu means like holy man, yeah, or holy person. And if you read the suttas, the word of the Buddha, this was already used in India 2,500 years ago. It was already called sadhu. So you can see this word is continuing across. But there was a story of this Indian sadhu, and he said that for some reason the third eye, or was it not third eye, but the mind reading anyway, mind reading opened up. And he wasn't sure exactly how it happened. And suddenly he can read everyone's thoughts. And he said it was kind of cool for a while, but then it became so oppressive because those thoughts were just so terrible usually. But then he wasn't able to turn it off anymore. He couldn't turn it off. So he had to read all these terrible thoughts all the time, and he had no choice about it. And this is kind of, but what that shows you is that reading other people's thoughts, actually, it is not really worthwhile. Actually, it's not pretty useless thing to do, because most of the things that we think about may not be terrible, but they're kind of, pretty boring stuff, mundane, ordinary things. We think about kind of little, small things, tiny things. I don't know what you think about, but when I look at my own mind, I wonder, why am I thinking about this? This is completely crazy. There was a meditator down in our center in Perth, and he said that after a while, his mind started to kind of, after a while, he ran out of things to think about because he had thought about everything pretty much. And once he had run out of things to think about, his mind started creating new stuff. So he had just washed a shirt or something, and he had hung that shirt on the line outside. And now he was sitting in meditation. He was thinking about what was the best way to hang that shirt on the line. He had run out of everything else and now kind of getting back to the really stupid stuff. And this is what our minds are like. Sometimes we think about things that are so pointless and so useless. So hopefully your friend, you were able to kind of convert him, to real Buddhism after a while. So allow them to come along. It's okay. Learn a bit of meditation. And hopefully they will kind of see common sense after a while and kind of come to something more useful there. Okay.
Thank you, Achan. I really enjoy your talk tonight. I'd like to come back to one of the points you talk about having compassion for someone who's already pre-programmed to be disagreeable.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, in your opinion, how much can we reprogram, or so to speak, to rewire our brain?
Okay. Oh, we can rewire it. That's the good news. Yeah, it can be rewired. It can be reprogrammed. So the program doesn't mean we are stuck and we have to be like this forever, because that would be like determinism. There would be no way out. There would be no way of spiritual developing. But the point rather is that at this particular moment, you can only be the person you are right now, because all the cause and conditions that come to you now, you can't really do anything about that. But if you over the long term, term, the person you are tomorrow, or the person you are the day after tomorrow, or next year, or whatever, will depend on how you react to what is happening to you in the present moment. So who you are now is given, but how you react to who you are, that is not given. And you can change that reaction if you have good influence on you, like the Buddhist teachings or whatever else it is. So there's enormous potential for spiritual developing and changing yourself. It just depends on your ability to persevere and commit to the practice. The more you persevere and commit, the more ability you will have. But start with yourself. And one of the kind of interesting things when you start with yourself and try to change yourself is that you learn how difficult it is, because that programming is often very strong. Yeah. If you say to yourself that from now on I'm not going to get angry in these particular situations, it's actually very hard to do that, yeah, because there's a certain habit that is so strong. You know, whenever your wife says A, you always get a bit upset, yeah, because she's done that 1,000 times before, and now you're kind of stuck. You're stuck with that perception in a sense. Have you got a wife, by the way? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Sorry about that. Is it okay?
It's not a reason why we're sitting apart.
it's just life. Yeah, I know what life is like, even though I'm monk. Yeah. So you understand that there is development. There is also hard to change our habits. And one of the things that comes out of that is that you start to have much more compassion for other people. Very often, we demand other people to change. Yeah, especially husband and wife often demand change from each other. But actually, when we understand how difficult it is to do it even with our own mind, we start to become less demanding of the people around us. And this is one of the great benefits of having some insight into, you know, how conditioned we actually are. And also, it becomes kind of scary. Yeah? You see how conditioned you are, you see how strong your habits are, and then you know that if you don't do anything with that, you will carry it on into the future. So you may carry those same habits into a future life. In the future life, there may be no BF. You may not be reborn in Singapore. You may be reborn, who knows where you get reborn, on Mars or something. There's no guarantee there's Buddhism on Mars, even if they have colonies there. So because of that, because the uncertainty in the future, if you carry these habits with you, you don't know how they're going to develop, under what circumstances they may get even worse, and it might kind of sprout out, and you may get reborn in a mafia family or something like that, and then your defilements really have a chance to play out badly. So you understand two things. You understand not to place too much demand on other people, because you know how difficult it is to change your own habits, but you also understand the danger in these habits, so gain more of an incentive to actually do something about them and change yourself, so in the future you don't fall under their sway so easily. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah, thank you, Archana.
Yeah, okay, very good.
Thanks, Ajahn, for the talk just now. My question is related to today's topic, how to move forward in our practice. Clearly, we need to practice.
Yes.
That's number one. And also how to move forward rather than in circles.
In circles, okay.
In my experience, everyone learns a bit differently, and that probably our paths will be a bit different. Even though it's based on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And also, I would think that the gradual training is kind of a general structure. Or would you say that it is recommended for all? Or do you have other recommendations for better learning?
Okay, I would say the gradual training. You know a lot about the suttas already. That's pretty good. Yeah, that's very nice. Gradual training is applicable for everyone. Yeah, so you can use that in your own practice. You can sort of figure out where you are. You can see the gradual training. You can sort of see where you're at roughly in that training. Yeah, and what you have to do, what you have to focus on. You will see your weaknesses there. You will see your strengths or whatever in that gradual training. So you can always use that. One of the things that I think is important is to, again, the idea of commitment is kind of the really important one. Once you gain a sense of faith and understanding in the Buddha Suttas, and obviously you have quite a bit of understanding already, then stick to that which you understand. Stick to that where you have your faith and confidence. Don't move too much around with all kind of different teachings, all kind of things. Once you feel confident with a certain thing, stick with that to a certain degree. And once you stick with something and you investigate that fully and you use that in a very deep sense in your practice, then eventually the results will come. Yeah, so it's a matter of really committing to one particular thing in a deep way, and then things will start to happen as a consequence. But it is not always easy, and particularly even in monastic life, sometimes it can be hard. But certainly in lay life, much more difficult because there's so many more distractions, so many things more going on. Yeah, so you have to commit even more, and you have to be even more careful. So make one of the things that is the most important thing is, and this is what comes out of the idea of Kalyanamitta in the suttas, is to make sure you get a regular doses of Dhamma, yeah? A regular sutta, a regular talk about the sutta, whatever it is. And as you do that, you will gradually, it will kind of keep you, it will lift you up, yeah? It will keep you aloft and keep you kind of heading in the right direction. But yes, it does take a lot of contemplation and reflection and all of these kind of things to keep you moving in the right direction. But as you do that, it will eventually bear fruit, I think. Okay. Very good.
Thank you, Ajahn. I'm asking this question on behalf of my friend. So, when is the next Maitreya Buddha coming?
Okay. That's the wrong question, yeah? You got the wrong question. If you have the wrong question, there's no answer. So, the Buddha says when you have the wrong question, he just remains silent. So, I've already said too much. This is the problem. So this is one of the things about one of the biggest problems in Buddhism is often looking to a future which is kind of uncertain and unreliable and no idea when it's going to come and what it is about. So much of Buddhism around the world is about worshipping Maitreya Buddha, this mythological person who may come one day and who may not come one day. Who knows? Yeah. And all we know, and this is quite certain, we know that the idea of a Buddha arising in the world, that happens at regular intervals, because that is like a natural phenomenon. Every now and again, a Buddha arises in the world, and that sort of happens. So we know, but whether it's going to be Maitreya Buddha or Karuna Buddha, Karuna is compassion Buddha, Maitreya is Metta Buddha, yeah? So whether it's going to be one or the Mudita Buddha or Upeka Buddha or some other Buddha, we don't know. Yeah? But the point is, it will happen at some stage. But actually, it is something that we cannot say anything about. The point is, and the problem is, that this whole idea of worshipping some Buddha in the future, really what it does, it takes away the value of the Buddha we have now. You have a Buddha now. The teachings are here. That Buddha reserves respect for having worked so hard to make these teachings available for us. And then we go worshipping a pie in the sky that we have no idea about. And that is very... very wrong, yeah. It's been disrespectful, I think, to the Buddha we have already. So the whole question about Maitreya Buddha is really, I think, is a flawed question to start with. And the idea of Maitreya Buddha in the Pali Canon only occurs once in the Pali Canon, and that particular one occurrence seems to be a late addition to the canon. Yeah, it's not something that was actually there from the beginning. This has been studied by people who do comparative study of the suttas. So really, there is no. It's a later myth that came after the Buddha. The Buddha never predicted Maitreya Buddha. Someone else did that. Probably someone who was a scholar or something who had no insight. Okay, we know there's Buddhas. Let's call him Maitreya. So we add that in there. So we have Maitreya Buddha. That's probably what what happened. So it is going down the wrong path, and I think it's so important that we stop these kind of wrong trends in our society, because it is such a common thing. You know, you see these enormous temples being built to Maitreya Buddha around, enormous statues, and people are becoming like a god. You worship Maitreya Buddha, yeah? He doesn't have any teachings, nothing. You can't really practice what he says, yeah? So nothing to practice, but you kind of worship Maitreya Buddha. Or some kind of god or something like that. And the whole thing becomes very, very problematic as a consequence. So tell your friend to come up with a better question, and then we might might answer it next time around. Okay.
Two last questions.
Thank you, Ajahn, for the wonderful talk. My question relates to one of the earlier ones where
as we go deeper into our practice, we're supposed to feel more joyful and feel more compassionate. And so does that mean that for someone who is practicing but doesn't necessarily feel more joyful or more happy, it's regressing in the practice, in the sense that, for example, when one tries to follow the five precepts, you cannot kill, for example, and then you see a cockroach or a lizard in the house, for example, and then that urge comes, and then you're supposed to go and, you know, try to follow the precepts. It's a bit of dukkha there.
Yeah, okay.
So this is just a very trivial example, but it's also in a sense like how you deal with other people, especially like parents. If one finds that certain behavior of the parents, it's exactly what Buddha says should not do, and you see that in the parent, and you know it's wrong, and you're very worried that you don't want to be influenced into becoming, you know, influenced by people around you. So then there becomes this pain as well, because you see in others what someone who's very close to you, but it goes against the teaching of the Dharma. And so how does one, how should one think about such things of being true, wanting to be true to the Dharma and the teachings, and yet, you know, not wanting to feel that pain and dukkha as well? So I need some advice, Ajahn. Thank you.
Okay, one of the things is that sometimes there is going to be pain. There is pain that comes from, you know, the spiritual practice. And it is sometimes that is unavoidable. But so really what it is about is using that pain in a skillful way to then again to advance your understanding of things. And it's always difficult. You know, you see all the pain in the world. You see you can look on TV, you see all the refugees, and it kind of feels terrible. The world there is a lot of pain in the world. That's the reality. But there's also a lot of joy in the world at the same time. There are happy people out there. There are people who practice the spiritual the path. So you try to find that balance. And when you find a balance, then you can carry on, because you know there is hope on the one hand, even though there's also a lot of suffering in the world there. So that suffering is, you do your best to influence the people around you, to kind of give them a chance to see something better, whether it's your parents or whoever it is that kind of are doing kind of the wrong thing. But the ultimate lesson in so many of these things is sometimes you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, I can't do anything more. I've done my very best. And you have to let go at a certain point. You can support your parents now. One day they're going to die. So what are you going to do? When they die, you definitely have to let go. You can't do anything more then. They could have died already, in which case you already kind of, they would have moved on, and you wouldn't worry so much about it. So just remember this. You do so much as you can while they're here, but also you understand the limits of what you can do. And at that comes a point where you have to learn to let go. You have no choice. And because you understand you have no choice, when you understand that, it actually helps you to do that. With the cockroach, the idea with the cockroach is that you have to try to see the world from the cockroach's point of view. It's very hard, but it can be done. What is the cockroach's point of view? He wants to live. I want to live. I just want to run around. I want to eat a little bit here, eat a little bit there. Even cockroaches have feelings. That's a kind of important point. So if you're able to see the world a little bit from the cockroach's point of view, just knowing that they want to live, knowing that what they want to do, you straight away you have more compassion towards them. Same thing with the mosquito. Mosquito comes and wants to bite you. It's one of the kind of really hard things when you have if you want to sleep at night and there's a mosquito in your room buzzing around. It's very hard to sleep sometimes. But remember, mosquito also, they just kind of want to do their own thing. They want to live. They just want to have a meal. They want to have some blood or whatever. And actually, so you have to put yourself in other beings' position. And when you do that, you actually are able to have much more compassion for them. And then you try to catch that cockroach in a humane way, in a humane cockroachy way, whatever it is. And that is the kind of, this is one of the things that makes these things possible. I remember when some of the, even in the Christian tradition, some of the great saints, like Saint Francis of Assisi, he was a very famous saint in the Catholic tradition in the 13th century or whatever. And he was famous for having, he had lice in his hair, and people would have at those times. And he would kind of leave them there because he realized, actually, I don't want to kill those lice. I have too much compassion for the lice. This is in Christianity, where they don't really have this idea of looking after animals in the same way that we have in Buddhism. But he just naturally had compassion. He understood the life, they want to live, yeah. They want to kind of have a good life as well. So you allow them to, you allow them to live as well. So you find a balance in your life, yeah. And this is kind of the thing. You find this, sometimes it is, on occasion, it may be okay to kill. If you have some kind of intestinal worm, for example, if I had an intestinal worm, I probably would go to the doctor and ask for something to get rid of it, because it's just that's too much, it's going too far. So occasionally you may break your precepts, but you try to the best of your ability to keep them in those difficult situations. And very often it's just a matter of your attitude. Yeah, your frame of mind is often going to make the whole difference of whether you're able to keep them or not. So these things are difficult things, but you know, if you are wise and you keep on thinking about, you know, how to deal with this, I can guarantee you will find solutions to it that are suitable and appropriate in accordance with the Dhamma teachings. Yeah.
We have time for one last question. Then we take a break and see if John Bramali is not too tired to come back at 10:45.
Yeah, see what happens. Yeah.
Thank you, John Bramali, for the talk today.
Yeah.
Regarding the topic today about practice, one of the Eightfold Path is about right effort, right? I mean, we want to maintain wholesome actions and get rid of the unwholesome actions.
Yeah.
As you mentioned earlier on, we all have flaws, but imperfect. So sometimes we do things that we know we're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
So my question to you is like this. Is there any practical tips or advice that you have for people that sometimes you may maybe out of impulse or out of without being too mindful that you start to do certain things that are not so wholesome? What can you do to stop those thoughts or actions before you know, it comes to becomes, you know, fruit?
Okay. Well, the obvious answer is to be mindful, yeah? So that's the obvious answer. So the question is, how to be mindful? That's the question, yeah? How can we actually improve the mindfulness? Yeah, sorry?
I mean, I know it's supposed to be mindful.
Yeah.
But I know it's meant to be
that
how do you exhibit the mindfulness?
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. So the answer is mindfulness. But the question is how to be mindful. You know, how can we actually be mindful when things go, when things get difficult or things get very busy or whatever? That's kind of the trick here. And the first thing to remember is that all you really need is enough clarity to know that now I'm not mindful. And sometimes you know that. Sometimes you know that you're kind of going the wrong track already. You know something isn't quite right. So very often when that happens, you know that now I should act and speak as little as possible. Because whatever's going to come out of my mouth is not going to be very good. Yeah? So this is the first thing, to actually have enough awareness simply to know that now something isn't quite right. And therefore I have to be careful. This is the first thing. But the other thing, which is you know, fundamental to mindfulness, this is one of the things I was saying before, is that mindfulness arises from two things, and that is your sila in general, but the other thing is your view, yeah, and the view, the udraka ditti, the right view. The more you have a view that is in accordance with the reality, the more you understand how important the spiritual practice is, how fundamental that is for all happiness in life, for everything to work out. The more you get that, the more scared you will be of doing the wrong thing. And because you are scared, there will be something at the back of your mind that will remind you, yeah, at all times, okay, now I'm about to go wrong, now I'm about to head in the wrong direction. So often what you have to do is just to reflect more on what really matters in life, what is important, these things that we call right view, putting the spiritual life first and putting everything else, make everything else secondary. And as you do that, the mindfulness will actually arise at the time when you need it. Why? Because those things that are very important to you, those things that you really value in life, yeah, they will be there at the back of your mind, and they will kick in when you need it in this kind of situation. So reflect on it again and again. What actually really matters in the world? What really, at the end of the day, what is it that's really important to me? What is it I'm going to feel good about when I eventually have to die? And we all know what that is. So make that strong, make it powerful, and then you will tend not to make these kind of mistakes in the future. This is a long-term thing. Yeah, you have to do it again and again and again. But as you do that, eventually it will start to kick in and something will start to happen. So, yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahmani. Let's say three sadhus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So let's pay respect and let Ajahn go in and rest first while I make some announcements. Let's pay respects to the Buddha together.